Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. So as I speak to you, broad, you know, widespread audience all over the known universe, because PRN reaches places that even regular podcasts don't reach. Actually, I do have listeners in India, Australia. It's just an amazing thing, absolutely amazing. Who could have thunk, right? Who could have thunk this so long ago? But as I speak to you, a blizzard, it's on its way to New York City. They say it's going to be an epic blizzard. But, you know, I mean, if you listen to the weather reports, it always has to be exaggerated. But sometimes it's not exaggerated. You notice I say blizzard. Instead, I use the French pronunciation for blizzard, blizzard. Because I went to some very good schools. I did. I didn't do anything when I was there. But I actually went there every day. So I, you know, I have a cultured background, God help me. No, actually, I'm an autodidact. You know what an autodidact is? No? It's a really fancy word. I just learned it about 15, 20 years ago. That's fairly new, right, in my life, anyhow. It's somebody who's, it just means somebody who's self-educated. Autodidact means somebody who's self-educated. So I'm more or less self-educated, even though I did actually go to college. I really wasn't paying attention. I was paying attention to whatever else I was paying attention to. So I have my own education. That's why it's so patchy and spotty and I get facts wrong. And so, you know, I know you all forgive me for that. Last week I was talking about the Lower East Side of Manhattan. a very famous neighborhood, probably still famous, but famous for various reasons. And really not a New York neighborhood necessarily, but an American neighborhood. The Lower East Side of Manhattan was where, and this is what I was talking about partially last week, was where all the poor immigrants, mostly Jews, who came around between 1880s and like 1920, they came from Eastern Russia mostly. I mean, not Eastern Russia, but from the Eastern Europe, from Russia, from Poland, from from parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So it's really Eastern Europe and Central Europe, but mostly Eastern Europe. And most of them showed up here without much of an education because they weren't allowed to have an education back where they were. And I was talking about my grandmother, who went from arriving here hardly speaking the language at all at the age of 9 years old and graduating when she was 21, fluent in English, reading and writing and speaking, and with a classics degree, Greek and Latin, from Hunter College. She was really quite something. But in fact, there were thousands and thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of stories very similar to that. This kind of willpower that got these people from this horrible place where they were being murdered and raped and their villages burned down and treated in the worst possible way because they were Jews, showed up here. And they all landed in this really awful tenement neighborhood. I mean, it was the poorest place in the entire country. No place poorer than this place. And people packed together filth, roaches, rats, holes in the wall, working 7 days a week, sometimes 12, 14 hours a day. They didn't have anything like a six-day week even. And it was an existence that I think most of us would just fold underneath in probably a couple of months and just go nuts or get sick, which a lot of people did in those days. But people were strong. They stood up to it. They came from a place where they had to be strong, and most of them stayed strong and got stronger. So quite an interesting group of people. But and I did mention that when my grandmother came to this country, it was, let's say call it the year 1900, she lived on the Lower East Side and in one of these already old kind of beat-up tenements. Not that old, but, 50, 60-year-old building. And these buildings, I was working in this same neighborhood. My first job out of college was working in this very same neighborhood that when my grandmother came over. And I was mentioning strange historical layering involved there, the spiritual and geographical layering of history, personal history and cultural history that's involved in me showing up and working in this first place. And not that I chose to work there. I joined the welfare department because I wanted to be in the civil service. I had jobs. There were jobs available, as I mentioned last week, in the insurance industry and various businesses. I'll have some water now, if you don't mind. Yeah, if I wanted to get started in business, you start at the bottom of the ladder and you climb up if you don't miss any rungs. And finally, you wind up, a manager, district manager, senior vice president, blah, 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 blah. But it just wasn't for me, unfortunately, very unfortunately for me and anybody connected with me or dependent on me in my life, I have never had ambition for or talent for making money. I have never made any real money. I have had money sort of drop on me from various extreme circumstances, inherited money, money that I got because of accidents that happened to other people. But I never, and I've worked real hard in my life, but never made any money. But I guess I didn't want to. And what I wanted to do was that I wanted to do good for various psychological reasons and because of the way I was brought up. In a kind of a left-wing, milieu, an old Rooseveltian left-wing milieu in New York City, by a sort of group of or a class of Jewish people who were dedicated to helping other people. That was their that was what the rabbi preached, and that was what I sort of absorbed. And, yeah, there was the usual group of people who said, you got to make yourself a lawyer and a doctor. You got to make a lot of money. But there was another group of people who were more left-wing. There were people in my family who were members of the Communist Party in the 30s and who were very dedicated to social welfare. So the first job I wound up getting was in the welfare department. I was what's called a welfare worker. And I worked in the same neighborhood where all these poor Jews once upon a time lived. It was an extraordinary thing for me to work there. This was my first job was I had training in October of 1966. I graduated in June of 66. And I had some training and then a couple of months training. I don't know what they could train you for, but they train you how to fill out a lot of forms. This was the beginning of climbing the mountain of what in World War II they called chicken shit. I'm sure you've heard that phrase. It's probably archaic by now. Nobody uses that. But it was a big thing in World War II. They referred to the tens of thousands of rules and apparently stupid and unnecessary and obfuscating rules in the face of extreme danger sometimes, or risking your life, you had to fill out, you had to make sure that you observe certain rules. And especially the higher up you went, the worse it was in a way. I mean, if you became an officer, it got worse and worse. You had to fill out forms. But people would behave in a way and adhere to the rules of the service, which went back to time immemorial. And it was called chicken shit. All this little tiny little stuff that you had to do that got in the way of that had nothing to do with reality, that got in the way of actual efficient functioning sometimes, that actually put people in danger and risk people's lives. All these little forms you had to fill out, all these little rules you had to observe, or you got in trouble. Well, they trained us at the beginning. There was a million forms to fill out. For the state, for the city, for the welfare department. So they trained you in all of that. And then, because they can't really train you up in another sort of well-to-do neighborhood where the training center was for the New York City Welfare Department. They couldn't train you to, it was like, training. Is this a good, I'm not good at comparisons like this. But they couldn't train you for what it was like on D-Day, or they couldn't train you for what it was going to be like fighting in the Ardennes forest somewhere, or the Battle of the Bulge. They couldn't train you in that, although they tried to get as close as possible. They couldn't train you for the horrendous ordeal of combat back in some camp in the United States. But they trained us in how to fill out a lot of forms. It was the civil service, and the civil service was. And it probably still is. It is actually still built on thousands of forms that have to be filled out and fees and services and the correct stamps, as we all know who spend our lives, applying for various licenses and, the waiting in line and the filling out the form and the filing the fees. So they trained us in that. We had all kinds of forms to fill out. And then we were sent to different welfare centers, depending upon where we needed. And again, this was January and February of 1967, which was, of course, right smack in the beginning to the middle of the 60s, when everything was changing. And one thing that was changing was that people had no tolerance whatsoever and started to ignore completely all the chicken shit. All the rules were ignored. By the line workers, that is to say, by the combat troops, that is us, who were college graduates from the mid-60s and the later 60s. It was a time of paying no attention to these things. It was a time of actually rebelling against such things as being stodgy, uncreative, obstacles to achieving human connection, and actually part of a paternal system which had become rigid and judgmental and unfair and insensitive and even cruel. So this is what, this is part of what the 60s was all about, was rebelling against this stuff. But for me, it was an astounding experience. So they sent me down to the the Lower East Side to work, and I went to a place called the Lower Manhattan Welfare Center. The Lower East Side is, as it implies, that Manhattan is a big, long, narrow island. And just imagine the direction. So the lower part of it, not the complete lower part, but near the lower part of it on the eastern edge was a famously poor neighborhood that had been poor and nasty and dirty and dangerous almost since the very beginning of when the island was inhabited, way back when, with the Dutch and the British and then the Irish and later on the Jews and other groups that came in, the Hispanics, Puerto Ricans mostly in that neighborhood. It was a hard, tough, old neighborhood full of tremendous cultural history, filled with its own brand of revolution. A lot of social programs and a lot of communist cells existed on the Lower East Side. When these Jews came over from Eastern Europe, a lot of them were, brought with them a kind of hatred of authority because they grew up under the Tsar and they grew up under a rigid anti-Semitism and the rules of the state and the laws of places like Poland, Austria, Hungary, and Russia were used to oppress them. And so they developed a political attitude. A lot of them was a hotbed going all the way back to when they first arrived around 1900, 1910, 1920. There were dozens of newspapers. There were socialists. There were, all kinds. There's 12 different kinds of socialists. You have 5 different kinds of communists. But a lot of communists and the socialists wound up in this neighborhood. So it wasn't so odd, actually, when I think about it now that I'm thinking about it out loud, that, that when revolution was in the air and when there was anti-war activity and when there was extreme behavior towards social welfare and breaking rules and not obeying the man or not paying attention to authority, that wasn't discovered out of the blue by, the people who were the anti-war people and the hippies. It was not made up from nothing. This was the right neighborhood for it. It was actually in the ground. It was in the buildings. It was in the air down there. You know, it was a revolutionary place. It always had been a revolutionary place. There were movements later on, and still are movements, but there were movements which turned violent, and there were people who were arrested for this. In fact, there was an attack on Congress by Puerto Rican nationalists, people who want Puerto Rico to be free. Who wanted it to be, not to be a territory of the United States. So this kind of behavior was something that went on down there all the time. So it was a yeasty, feisty old neighborhood, dirty and strange and poor as it was. And that part of that was the poverty, of course. You feed people into an area over and over again who are oppressed in their old countries, like the Irish originally were down there. And then the Jews came in. And, the oppression and the brutality of the British to the Irish and then later the Russians and the Polish and the Austrians and the Hungarians to the Jews fed a lot of very angry people. And they came in there very angry, very anti-establishment, and also very poor. And put that all together, and they do not spell mother. They spell trouble. They spell revolution. They spell crime, too, at the very least. Some of it was directed politically. A lot of it was just plain crime. Some of the biggest criminals, the original gangsters who were part of, eventually part of the mafia, like Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel and all these people, all of them came from the Lower East Side, and a lot of extreme behavior, a lot of people like Al Jolson and Eddie Cantor and all these other people, very brash, adventurous people who later on, in fact, went on to develop the entire Hollywood movie industry, originally started as garment makers and garment salespeople from the and salespeople from the Lower East Side, scrabbling to make a living. They were tough people. They had to be. They were poor. They were, and there were a lot of children in these families. Same old story, right? Sound familiar? Always lots of children. 5, 6, 7, 8 children in a family. My grandmother's was one of 8 siblings. And did they, you know, and the Irish, you know, had a lot of kids, and the Jews had a lot of kids. And those, they said the Italians, there weren't so many Italians there. They had their own part of the tough, you know, poor part of Manhattan. But so that's where I went. That was where my first job was. And it was the strangest thing. And the Lower Manhattan Welfare Center was an old public school. These buildings were built, a lot of these buildings were built, you know, back in the late 1800s. And so they were old, creaky buildings, but they had been maintained pretty well. But it was a real old civil service building. It was on East 5th Street, between 1st and 2nd Avenue in Manhattan, which had been, as I mentioned already several times, a very overwhelming, teeming center for Jewish immigrants. And before that, for the Irish. And before that, I don't know who. And before that, of course, God help them. You know, may they all rest in peace, the poor Indians who lived here for how many thousands of years before the white people showed up. So this is what, so there was an old school, and it was repainted, you know, or maintained the civil service gray and green. Everything was gray and green and a kind of pallid poop brown. Those were the colors, right? And with gray metal desks, all beat up gray metal desks that had probably been there for, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years already by the time I sat at one of them. And old dark green metal file cabinets that didn't work quite right, you know, that the runners sometimes were warped, that when you pulled them out, they wouldn't go back in, or when you pushed them in, they wouldn't come back out. But that's what we had. And we had the old beat up desks, and we had a telephone on the desk, and we had a pencil, and we had a blotter. We had pencils, we had blotters, we had pens, and the walls were painted gray or green, and the floors were painted gray or, as I say, a kind of pallid poop brown. And it was a dismal place, except that the joint was jumping. The joint was jumping. It was like a lot of civil service places like this, and you don't see them too much anymore, or they've been refurbished, right? So they've got newer paint and sort of more lively looking, you know, decorations, chairs that don't look like they were pulled out of a dumpster somewhere. All of our stuff was so beat up, and it hadn't been replaced since 1938. You know, I started there 1967, 68, but it was really quite, you know, something. The civil service didn't receive that much money in the city. Although it was still part of all these welfare programs, especially sending aid to dependent children. Most of the people on my caseload were women with children who did not have any other means of support. There was no money coming in except what we sent them. Theoretically, our job as investigators, we were called welfare investigators. We weren't called social workers in those days. Now it's called I don't know what, human resources, social workers. In those days, we were called investigators, because the point was, in my first job here as a youth, and when I was 21, when I got out of college, I was probably emotionally about 15, and intellectually, who knows what. And I got out of college with my 50s, still with my 50s, not crew cut, but with my 50s short haircut, and, you know, with my... And I, you know, we were told, you know, wear a jacket and wear a tie and wear office pants and wear shoes. You know, don't go in there with sneakers and jeans and all beat up clothes. This is not your backyard. This is a professional office. So we were told to do this. And out of respect for the clients, they were called clients. Kind of a commercial sounding word, isn't it? They were our clients. So, but we were investigators. We were investigators because the point was that even though, you know, the Roosevelt era, you know, had spread such understanding and awareness and sensitivity to the suffering of the poor, still a lot of people, you know, there was a good old American work ethic. People did not trust the people on welfare to be stealing from them. And most people in society, and people I ran into all the time when I was a welfare worker and later on after I was a welfare worker, just took it for granted that these people, all these women, you remember welfare queens and things like that, that all these women And there were, you know, tens of thousands of them all over the city, and a lot of them concentrated down in the neighborhood that I worked in. They just took it for granted that they were stealing, that they were, you know, that had other money, that they were prostitutes, that they had three cases open at one time, that there were men coming in there and giving them money, and they were getting money from the city. People would envision these people as getting rich off the welfare department, which, believe me, if you worked there, was a bitter, stupid, insensitive joke. These people, even if they were getting extra money, that's why we were called investigators, not social workers. We weren't there to help them get better or to make their lives better so much as just to maintain them and also to investigate them, to make sure that the money, and it makes sense, you know, the hard-earned tax money of everybody that was going to support them since there was no other money wasn't being, you know what, gambled away or thrown away or, you know, used for drugs or used to bet the numbers, whatever it was. It wasn't just a supplement to some man or group of men that helped support these women, too. So we would investigate these people. We would go out and ask them, did they pay? They had to show us evidence. Where is the Con Edison bill? Where is the, we called it the light bill, because people referred to it in Spanish as la luz. And you had to learn a little Spanish to do the job down there. We had to look at this, what the rent was paid. We had to see a rent receipt. We had to see the light bill was paid. We were told to actually check in the closets to see if there were any men hiding there, which I just couldn't bring myself to do. One time I heard some noises in the closet. Now, you can often hear noises in these places because there were a lot of rats there. And they were old buildings and they would creak. But we were, you know, one time I heard some noises that seemed definitely human. But I'm not going to, you know, it wasn't in me to go checking in closets. Well, we were instructed to do that, to go checking in other rooms, to go through all their apartment. And I mean, if we had, you know, if they got away with flashlights and, you know, tasers, or cattle prods, they would have given it to us to make sure that there was no men hiding there. But in fact, there were cases like that, but not as many as the society in general thought. There were cases where, you know, where men were living with these women. They weren't married to them, but they were living with these women. And they did have, you know, they would have kid after kid after kid. And, you know, it was considered bad form to advise them. We weren't there to do family planning. So, but once in a while, you know, you would sit there and, you know, somebody, you'd show up and, or somebody would call you up, one of your clients. And we visited them once every 3 months, I think it was, just to check and see. You know, we had a huge number of cases. And we would drop in and we would see, they'd call us up and say, I want to let you know I'm pregnant again. A lot of times through an interpreter, right? Because it was, most of them spoke Spanish and didn't speak English very well. I want you to know I'm pregnant again. This is a 21-year-old woman who's already got three children. She's telling you she's pregnant again. And a lot of these women kept getting pregnant all the time. And the city paid for it. We paid for it. The taxpayers paid for it. So there was this tug of war, this strain between the social welfareism of the Roosevelt era, which was carried through, by the way, this is during the time of Lyndon Johnson. Speaking of Lyndon Johnson and his poverty programs, and you could see that in the movie Selma. Johnson was very much for helping people, you know, Medicare, the war on poverty. And so, and he was an old, you know, Roosevelt congressman. He was an old, you know, follower of Roosevelt's and very much dedicated to the poor. So it was my first job. And it was very strange to come from this place, Laurelton, this community, which was out in Queens, where I came from, where I grew up, which was a neat little tiny lower middle class place. Every lawn was watered. It was trimmed. The weeds were pulled. I never saw a rat until I started working in the welfare department. I never saw a roach till I started working in the welfare department. I never saw squalor till I started working in the welfare department. Poverty, I never saw poverty like that, or filth, or I never saw dangerous, crazy-looking people like I did, except in my own house. I never saw such dangerous, crazy-looking people as I saw routinely down there. We were across the street from the 9th Precinct Police Department, we could looked out my window on the third or fourth floor of this old school building, and we were all divided into separate units. And I would look out, and I would see the cops routinely, you know, detectives or plainclothes cops, bringing in criminals that they had picked up on the street, you know, drug addicts, dealers, murderers, whatever. And believe me, down there, it was very difficult to tell the difference between the cops and the criminals. They all had this hard case, rough, nasty, angry look, like they beat you over the head in 2 seconds. And you couldn't tell which were the cops and which were the criminals, except if you, you know, naturally, if one of them was shoving the other one and one of them had cuffs on, it gave you a couple of clues. But otherwise, if they walked in anything like parallel to each other or together. And later on, I never saw police corruption. Of course, there was police corruption all over the city. This was the 60s leading into the 70s. And after that, it was, you know, all Serpico and hearings and everything. But, you know, out where I was, the police were all sort of older guys, you know, guys who were about to retire, guys with big bellies, you know, guys who couldn't run after criminals anymore. You got farmed out. It was kind of a place they put you when you were about to retire. And it was all old Irish cops with big beer bellies, and they didn't even like to get out of their cars. And they didn't need to where I lived. They didn't need to get out of the cars where I lived. And it was not a foot patrol place. There was a lot of foot patrol down on the Lower East Side because it was all happening on the street every second, you know. And the cops out where I grew up, you know, they just dozed in their car or sort of drove their car about 15 miles an hour cruising through the streets to see if anybody had maybe stolen a lollipop from a little kid. That's about the level of crime that happened in my neighborhood. And like I say, I came from this clean, orderly, neat, straight environment where everything was all like, you know, father knows best in America and U.S. kids and crew cuts and everything was everybody did what they were supposed to. Everybody did their homework, you know. And I go to this place. I couldn't have gone to a more extremely different place, 180 degree opposite. So it was astounding to me. And it was my first job. I never had a job before. I never had a real job, like in an office where I made my own money. Also, I had my first apartment where I had to pay for my own food. I had to pay the rent. I had to pay the phone bill. I had to pay the electric bill. All these things, right? My first salary at the welfare department in 1967 was $5,750. And it was more than enough in those days. Can't say why, but, you know, it was more than enough to pay for a decent enough life. You know, it paid for transportation. It paid for, you know, washing my clothes, buying food, paying the rent. My rent was $97 a month for a three-room apartment. This is, now these figures sometimes don't even mean anything. You know, you adjust for inflation. I think what I'm trying to say here is, boys and girls, that although I made so much less money, things cost so much less. Things cost so much less. I was able to buy steak for $1 a pound. You know, that's the way it was in those days. So $5,750 was enough to get by on. I mean, you know, you couldn't put any money by or save any money. So I worked in this old school building in this neighborhood. And like I say, I had never seen anything like this before. My caseload was mostly Hispanics. Do you use the word Latinos anymore? Somebody who is Hispanic advises me that Latino is not the correct word to use, that Hispanic is the correct word to use. So I'll use that word. And it was mostly Puerto Ricans, and some of them had been on welfare since they were born. And some of them, their mothers had been on welfare. And I had even one case where I had a grandmother and the mother and a younger mother, all three generations on welfare. And it did give a lot of grist for the mill for people who were, you know, angry about this. But there was nothing. These people did not speak English. They had no education. There was no place that was going to hire them. And out of ignorance and out of whatever else, they were having too many kids. They were having too many kids. But in those days, under Johnson, it was very liberal and very expansive. It got much tighter. It was much tighter before that, of course. I mean, after in the 40s and 50s, people didn't want to put up with this kind of stuff so much. People got tight on these people, and they were investigated. Some of them were thrown off welfare into whatever kind of poverty they could exist. I mean, I don't know how they lived. But when Johnson came in, it was kind of a resurgence of understanding people on poverty and aiding people on poverty. But there was no providing education. There was no jobs for these people, so they just stayed on welfare. And as I say, some of them were two, sometimes three generations on welfare. So the majority of my caseload were these people. And then I had a Bowery caseload. And these are the guys who, you know, this is like from the Iceman cometh. These are the guys who lived in Bowery, you know, these these down and out, flea-bitten, roach-ridden, rat-ridden old hotels on the Bowery in New York City, which goes all the way back to a really bad time, right? The Bowery. And once upon a time, you know, like all these neighborhoods, it had a time when it flourished. But when I got down there, I mean, there were people living in places called the Terminal Hotel, for instance. The Terminal Hotel, and believe me. And these people, these were guys, old, you know, old guys, 50s, 60s, 70s, guys, old drunks who didn't even know their own names. I would go out and have to, like, you know, provide them a check. And then they got basic, they almost got no money whatsoever. It was something called home relief, which is way back from the 30s. That's something that Roosevelt came up with. But, you know, before Roosevelt's administration, there was no money at all for these people. Either they died of malnutrition and disease, or just exposure to the elements, or they were supported by charities. Anybody who was poor down in these neighborhoods, and like a lot of the Jews were at one point, and sometimes the Irish, were supported by their own people. So people who had made it, you know, richer politicians for the Irish and business people and people who had made it for the Jews, they had many, many, many charitable organizations that gave money routinely to the poor down there because there was no government program to give welfare to anybody to provide for these people. How they lived, I don't know, and probably a lot worse than they lived on welfare, as bad as that was. So this is so I'm emphasizing this change, and for me it was nuts to go from this clean, orderly place where the mailman came at the same time every day, and everything was the grass was cut in green, and there was no bugs, and there was no poverty, to go down to this place surrounded by out and out squalor, brutality, corruption, crime. I saw guns. I saw people, you know, popping pills and shooting, you know, spikes into their arms in the hallways. I never saw anything like this. And it was a constant source of amazement. And I have to confess, kind of adventure for me to go down to this place. I never felt myself in danger, but sometimes people got hurt. Some welfare workers got hurt. But they usually took us for cops because most of us looked sort of conservative, except it was the time of the hippies. So things were changing. The people who were the supervisors down there and the case supervisors, the people who were in the administration and the supervisors were left over were Jews, Irish, and blacks who had worked hard through the Depression. Some had been in World War II, and they took their job very seriously as investigators and keeping all the forms filled out, all the rules obeyed, and making sure people didn't get away with cheating the welfare department. For everybody else my age who came in there, except for, you know, sort of prudish, square guys, I was as prudish and square a person as you could possibly imagine. But a lot of people around me, people my age and a little older, were into, hey, man, that's cool. You had another kid? Oh, sure, yeah, what the hell? You know? And people, their hair was long, and they were wearing day-glow clothes into the work, and they would be screamed at by these old-fashioned Irish guys and the black people and the Jews who would say, that's not the way you dress, young man. That is not the way you dress when you come into an office. And they would say, hey, whatever, you know? Why don't you just dress that way yourself? You know you want to. You don't even wear that stupid, you know, people didn't talk rudely like that. But they would say, oh, okay, far out, you know, because half of them were high. You know, I walked through a welfare center where half the people, the welfare workers, were tripping on LSD or had been smoking pot in the basement or taking pills or whatever or selling drugs in there. They once sent an undercover cop in because there was so much drug dealing going on. in my welfare center of the hippie variety more than the hard heroin type, right? And they sent an undercover cop in. And everybody knew who he was because why? Because he came in with a worse crew cut than mine, white socks, black pants, looking like a Hollywood casting director's idea of an undercover cop. They picked him because he was young looking, right? In a week, they took him out because everybody would start calling him officer in the hallway. He was supposed to uncover the vast hippie drug ring that went on there. But that was the other thing about it. Amidst all this craziness and all the old, and I had old Jews, too, had been abandoned, old Jewish people who had not made it out to Long Island or Westchester or the suburbs. A lot of the Jews from the turn of the century when my grandmother came over, they worked hard, and a lot of them, by the 20s and 30s, they were on their way out of the Lower East Side, like a lot of other immigrant groups. You know, they made money, they got an education, blacks, Irish, the Jews, and they worked their way out into the other boroughs where it was cleaner and nicer, just like my grandmother and my parents' generation worked hard, went to college, and got us little neat little houses out in Queens in the suburbs. But some of these old Jews got left behind. Now, I had one old Jewish lady they all lived on the fourth floor. There was a rule, apparently an unwritten rule, that if you're on welfare, you had to live on the fourth floor so that the welfare worker had to walk up and down four flights of stairs. And these were such old buildings, and so many people had walked up and down them, you know, a total of hundreds of thousands over the years, that the marble steps, all the steps were made of marble, old beat-up marble. They had a depression in the middle. It was like a saddle, a depression in the middle where people walked up the middle of the steps. This is one of these places. People used to throw garbage out the back windows into the air shaft, right? And rats running up and down. Rats would run right past you or sit in a corner and just stare at you. But so in the midst of all this old-fashioned, you know, chicken shit stuff in the civil service and providing for people and all this incredible things I was experiencing, you know, all these cops and all this strange stuff and the old Jewish people and then food I never ate before, you know, like going to these old Jewish delis and going into Hispanic restaurants and having this great stuff was the thriving of the hippies, the East Village. You know, it was Haight-Ashbury East. It was that was where the concentration was on the East Coast. It was Tompkins Square. Now it's a really fancy neighborhood, but. There were people there, you know. So there I was in the midst of all this, like Candide. I'm walking around this place, old fashioned, and in fact, I was. I said I was prudish, and there was sex everywhere. This is the time of, you know, like free sex and drugs and the electrics. There was a place called the Electric Circus, and there was rock and roll everywhere. And people were sometimes really violent. I mean, it was also there was the cops sometimes would charge down there. There were anti-war demonstrations. People would sleep in the park. They would walk around barefoot down there. This is a time of the complete flowering and the expansion out of control, like Jack and the Beanstalk, of hippiedom. And I walked through all this strangeness and squalor and brutality and hippie excesses still encased in my scared little Queens neurotic. I wore a sport jacket still in the midst of all this. And meanwhile, all this stuff is going on. And I would walk around and people would walk up to me in a hallway and say, I walk out of my office where I'm just being yelled at by my Irish supervisor, you know, who's 50 years old. And he says, you didn't file your form 103B, and if it's late one more time, what? They never fired anybody. Everybody there was a drunk. Nobody could be fired from the civil service. The people who weren't taking drugs were old-fashioned drunks. And, they belonged on welfare. There were people who would pass out at their desks and couldn't be fired. He'd say, you know, you're going to be in a lot of trouble if you don't file your 103Bs. I say, all right, you know, I'll get him in, you know. And so I'd walk out of there, and in the hallway, some guy said, hey, man, you want to score a little acid? That's the kind of place I went. That was my first job. We'll be right back.
many sights to see. And when I look in my window, so many different people to be, that it's strange, so strange. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. Mm-hmm. Must be the season of the wind. Looking over his shoulder at me, and he's strange. Sure is strange. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. Yeah, beatniks out to make it.
Season of the Witch, yeah. So there I am walking through this crazy world, coming from a place, and that's the point, see, coming from a place where everything was absolutely routine, the 50s really, a neighborhood that was where I was living in the 50s and walking straight into the 60s. Like I walked through a door and walked from also a neat, orderly, lower middle class neighborhood into utter poverty and insanity. So all around me, people have long, shaggy hair and beards and walking around barefoot and look like something from an R. Crumb comics. And there was drugs everywhere. I mean, you could get a contact high walking the streets down in these places. And on the other hand, there was drugs of another sort. There were people taking heroin. There were people playing numbers in the hallway with their welfare checks. I would walk up four flights of stairs to visit some old Jewish woman. And on the way up, you know, there would be two guys passed out. Who knows whether they were dead or not? And another guy, you know, I knocked on his door once to ask him, you know, could I come in? He was getting welfare, and he rips the door open. A cloud of smoke pours out, and he's got a gun pointed right in my face with the hammer pulled back. Right? Another time I'm walking up the steps, and some mangy dog came downstairs with foam coming out of its mouth. And I'm standing there paralyzed, and some old lady, maybe 90 years old, some old Puerto Rican lady, comes out of her apartment and says, in Spanish, she says something to the dog, says, get out of here. And the dog goes, woo, 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 and runs down the steps. Meanwhile, I thought it was going to eat me, right? Every day this is going on. I'm going out for lunch to places where I'm eating food that was so delicious and food that was so terrific that I never had. I mean, I never, you know, my grandmother made, there was a Jewish deli in my neighborhood. My grandmother made deli food, but I never had deli food like this before. Amazing stuff. You go into a Jewish, you know, go into an old Jewish restaurant, and I went in and I ordered matzo ball soup, right? And the waiter looks at me. There was nobody else in there at the time. It was like 2 in the afternoon. And the waiter looks at me and says, you don't want the soup. I said, what? It was like an old Henny Youngman joke. I said, what do you mean I don't want this soup? He said, you know what, the soup, it's, he looks over at the counter. He says, soup's not good today. He says, have the brisket. So I did. I had the brisket. It was pretty good, right? So I'm, you know, and I'm going into restaurants where everybody's speaking Spanish, and there's, I'm having, you know, cafe con leche, and I'm having flan, and I'm having a rose con pollo. I mean, really, I was having a time of my life. And it was strange, though, like I say, because I walked through all this, and then there was all this, you know, violence that was going on down there, and it wasn't so far under the radar. I mean, it was it was a time of the war, and things were starting to turn nasty. Things were going from flower child to you know, to fighting in the streets, and sometimes both were happening at once. So there was a lot of undercover cops. There was a lot of cops on the streets sometimes, because there were demonstrations that occurred in different parts of the city, and a lot of them were organized down there. And through all of this cultural, spiritual, class, you know, kaleidoscope of clashing ideas and experiences, I walked through all this. And finally, I became like everybody else in my generation. I came down there for personal reasons to help people, for whatever complex psychological reasons. I wanted to save people, right? I needed to do that because how I grew up. I was brought up to do that. And I came down there because I was taught by my my left-wing, you know, liberal relatives and other friends of mine, and their parents from the Roosevelt era, that this is what one does in the world, is help other people. So I'm down there trying to help people all the time. And I finally saw that through the chicken shit and through the forums and through all the other craziness, you couldn't help people unless you broke rules. And breaking rules was something everybody did. This was the generation that turned their back on rules. What was it? I never get it right. Tune in, turn on, and drop out? Or did you have to? Is that the right sequence? Oh, okay. I'm not sure if you had to tune in, or, but you did those three things, and I guess you did them in that order. But not me. I was afraid to take drugs. I didn't want anything to, you know, control my mind except me, which I imagined I was in control of. What a joke. But I was very scared. I was very prudish about sex. So I walked through this incredible place filled with sex and violence and craziness and poverty and people breaking rules all over the place. And finally, I broke down. I let my hair grow, you know, I didn't wear a sport jacket anymore, and I started breaking rules. And then I got worse than anybody. If I walked upstairs to see the old lady on the fourth floor, the old Jewish lady who was half blind, and she didn't have anything to do all day long. All her friends had long since died. She had no relatives. I checked in her background. You know, you'd had to spend 6 months checking down her relatives. But I found some, call them up on Long Island. They didn't want anything to do with her, you know, some nephew twice removed. Well, you know, the city supporting her? Yeah, okay. I called a guy out. He lives in some neighborhood where he's, you know, he's rich, literally. But he didn't want anything to do with her. Like, let the city keep supporting her. I don't know her. I don't know her. I never paid any attention to her. She never did anything for me. Oh, okay, great. So I walk up four flights of stairs, and she's up there. And, you know, people are always banging on her door. There's dents in her door because the junkies were always trying to break in. And, you know, I had to give her money to replace locks. So what I used to, what I did was typically I would say that something had happened to her refrigerator. I would write up in my official report. I fill out my form and write my official report after my visit and say, Mrs. Weissman's refrigerator broke down and she needs a new refrigerator. Landlord won't replace it. And they just took our word for it, right? We didn't have to supply evidence generally. It broke down. And what I did was I bought her television and I bought her a radio with the money for the refrigerator, which it was just, her refrigerator was just fine. So I lied all the time. I got to the point where I had to lie all the time to help anybody. And that's why I was down there, was to help people. That's why I was down there to help people. I wish I had the courage, because I wanted to drift further into the anti-war thing I was into. That was fine with me. On my, you know, on my non-working hours, I would go straight to an anti-war demonstration. And sometimes they could get pretty violent, cops with nightsticks and leashed dogs, sometimes unleashed dogs, you know. And but I never got into the hippie world, and I wanted to. All that sex that I was too prudish and afraid of for various complicated psychological reasons. All the drugs that people were taking, I didn't want anything to do with it. I want my mind floating around someplace else. I had enough trouble holding on to it as it was. My mind floated all by itself. Half the things that people told me they saw when they were on LSD or their revelations or flowers growing out of the sidewalk, I could see those on my own, and it wasn't very pleasant. But maybe for them it was. So I didn't need any chemicals to alter my consciousness. My consciousness was constantly being altered to the point where, like, I was in a boat out on a sea full of waves. So I didn't want to do that. And I walked through all this, and I tried to help people as much as I could. But I had to wind up lying and cheating. So if there was a girl and a family, there was one Hispanic family, where one of the girls, the middle girl, there were four girls in there that this woman had on welfare. And they were living in some projects down there. And she was told by her teacher that she had some musical talent. You know, they tried her out on some instruments in school. And but they couldn't afford music lessons, and they couldn't afford to buy her a violin. No problem. I was on the spot. I was there. I made up a kid. I said that this woman had gotten pregnant, and I made up a kid, made up the kid's name, made up the birth date, and made up her visit to the hospital, and added another kid to this family, a fictitious kid. I guess I was the father of the kid. And they got an extra allowance every week, and, you know, every 2 weeks, rather, in their check for this extra kid. And with that money, this girl bought a used violin and got music lessons, and on and on and on. And I wound up being as bad as anybody was down there, maybe even worse. I started giving lessons to people on how to cheat and fill out the forms wrong because it was the only thing you could do. We all, you know, I mean, I was no outlaw, but and there were some real outlaws down there, believe me. And, what you know, it wasn't all just, you know, drugs and flowers and smiles and, you know, peace and love. I mean, there was a lot of hard characters down there who took advantage of the hippies and took advantage of the hippie world, I mean, to make lots of money off them, too. And to take, you know, they were taken advantage of. But there was people sleeping in the streets, and there was revolution in the air, and there was and there was all this crime and drugs and poverty, and I needed to help. I needed to help. So I was living in this very, very strange world where every day I would go from Queens in my own apartment, where I was having trouble living on my own, tied as I was to my mother's apron strings and even other parts of her that I didn't want to even mention on the air. But we all wanted to help. We all wanted to help. And we'd like to think those people from the 60s, people make fun of the 60s now. It was all, you know, all like a lot of self-indulgence and stupidity and dropping out for no reason. And, yeah, a lot of people from the 60s, you know, finally went back the other way. They had to, you know, they had kids, or they had responsibilities, or they had drug habits, and they had to clean themselves up. It's true. But things changed permanently back there. We all had to think that we helped. We all had to think that we helped. I mean, we did help. You know, I questioned myself. What did I do? Yeah, it was my youth. Yeah, I had dreams. Yeah, I wanted to help people. And I did help people. I worked as hard as I possibly could. That was a job where people quit after 6 months. People burned out after 6 months on a job like that because people on welfare blame you for everything that happened to them. if somebody got sick, if they were poor and miserable and didn't have enough to eat, you're the government person that they saw. They blamed everything on you. Sometimes they'd get violent. Sometimes they'd throw a punch at you. Sometimes they would try to stick a knife in you. And people burned out after 6 months. But I kept at it. I kept at it for years. And after that, I went to another welfare center. But later on, I changed my attitude, and another thing came over me, and other things came up from my past, and I became a probation officer, which was a whole different way of helping society, believe me. But in those days, in the Lower East Side, and I miss those days. It was my first job. It was my youth. It was exciting. And if I think, did I help? Yeah, I did help. A lot of us helped, and I know I really did help. It was a time that I can look back and be proud of. Even if I was breaking the rules, I was helping people who were in need. And when you look around at all these people, the cops, the civil servants passed out on the desk, the poor women on welfare, you know, the people popping, you know, heroin into their veins, all of us, the welfare workers, even my supervisors, everybody is somebody's child. Everybody is somebody's child, and they all need help. Mm-hmm.